Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast. The Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny is a podcast that brings you the latest news and trends in and around the NFL. Join Mina and her guests such as NFL analyst Dominique Foxworth, insider and fantasy football focus host Field Yates, and ESPN Radio's Mike Golic Jr. If you like X's and O's, analytics, and probably too much dog talk, because Lenny is a dog, then give the Mina Kimes Show featuring Lenny a listen wherever you get your podcast. Also, NBA Today, hosted by Malika Andrews, offers exclusive content Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Alongside Malika, there will be a full cast of NBA experts and insiders, including Kendrick Perkins, Chinwe Igumike, Vince Carter, Zach Lowe, Adrian Wojnarowski, Ramona Shelburne, and many of our NBA reporters from around the league. Get caught up with the latest from around the NBA on NBA Today on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. And also available as a podcast. Listen to NBA Today wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we've got an interview with Mike Sielski. He is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, but also the author of The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality, his book about Kobe's childhood years. You'll want to check that out. But first... All right, so... We changed our schedule in the last year on how we do The Right Time. And so normally, or previously rather, we were on Tuesdays. This time we don't do shows on Tuesdays, and we actually were off for the Martin Luther King holiday. So I every year like to talk about Dr. King because I think it is important, given that what he is for a lot of people gets reduced to a bunch of disingenuous, like teddy bear types of quotes. And that's not to say that the teddy bear elements of Dr. King were not present. Like, the message of love was not a constant, and that is not something that people can take with them. It is something that you can, but if all you do is just take all the love one another quotes out of Dr. King, then you are absolutely missing the point of who and what he was. And King was a revolutionary. There's no way around that, right? There's plenty of ways that you can explain it, but without question, King was a revolutionary. But King being a revolutionary, and this is important, is not inconsistent with the message of love. In fact, you can make the argument that his idea of love is absolutely revolutionary in America because America is simply not a loving nation. There are certainly transactional relationships between people, between groups, within groups. But if we look at ourselves as loving people, we probably don't pass that test. I mean, we out here basically trying to kill each other with this damn virus just because people don't want to let nobody tell them what to do. That's not the kind of thing that happens in a place that is governed by love. And so it is always very interesting when you see people and they lean in on the ideas of King as such a loving being while also themselves supporting and pushing causes and ideas that are contrary and opposite of that. The thing about love is love typically comes with sacrifice. That's a big part of why it is that we just don't throw the word love around willy-nilly in our relationships with strangers, because how many strangers are you willing to sacrifice for? How much can you actually get done if you're out here making but so much sacrifice for people that you don't know? And so in application, we just don't typically see a lot of sacrifice that goes, again, beyond groups. And normally when we talk about groups, in that case, it's real small ones like families, right? Friend circles or something like that. But by and large, people ain't about to sacrifice that it takes to truly live and walk with love. And with the ideas on race that King had and the amazing strategic decision to ground everything in the very basic principles of Christianity, which particularly then, but even now, are the common bond between most people in this country, is a Christian value structure. Grounding that forced people to face what their hypocrisy was and not reacting in kind toward the violence and hostility that he received put so many people in a position where they had to own, this man really just might be a better person than you. And maybe that ain't something you should necessarily feel bad about, because King was a better person than pretty much anybody that this nation has ever produced. But at every turn, when you spit on those people and you slap those people and did all that stuff, those were better people than you. I was working on something that led to me going and looking up on the Wikipedia, the sit-ins in Oklahoma City that my mother was involved in. And I didn't realize until very recently that this sit-in even had a Wikipedia page. But I want to read this for you. And for those who don't know, the sit-in was at Catch Drugstore in Oklahoma City, and a group of teenagers led by an amazing woman named Clara Looper, who was an attorney in Oklahoma City. And the story was basically that they had gone to New York City to attend a play, and for them was the first time that they had been in a place that was not segregated. And it made them come back home and look around and be like, yo, what in the world are we doing here? Like, what is this? And so this group of incredibly courageous teenagers, 13 of them, went and sat down at the counter and ordered Cokes, right? They did this. Stayed there for 3 days, and then after 3 days, they were eventually served, and they then integrated the counter at this drugstore. But says here in the wiki, after their preparation, the first day of the sit-in began on August 19, 1958, when Clara Looper and the children sat down at the counter of the Catch drugstore and ordered 13 Cokes. They were refused service, but they stayed at the counter for hours while whites kicked them, punched them, spat on them, and poured things on them. They returned for 2 more days, and on the 3rd day of their protest, one of the employees served them their food, ending segregation in the restaurant. I'm going to say this one more time. Whites kicked them, punched them, spat at them, and poured things on them. These were literally children. My mother had turned 15 2 months prior to this. And this is the way that these people were treated. And King had the audacity to respond to that with an idea or a notion of love, which was him looking those people dead in the eye and saying, I'm a better person than you. Or maybe you yourself can see this and realize that this is not the person that you are, right? Maybe you are a better person than it appears that you are in this moment. Maybe that's what it is. But I look at that, like I think about like what that scene had to be and think about the fortitude that it required to be that man and approach this the way he did, in large part because that was the only thing that was ever going to work. That was it. Because our humanity is so discounted as black people that in order to get somebody to hear us very often, we then have to become superheroes. We have to rise above in a completely different way just to get somebody to listen, just to get somebody to hear. And that man and his followers were willing to do that. They were willing to take that. They were willing to eat them blows. They were willing to eat that indignity. And the people that were spitting on him are now going to come out here and put out his quotes about love. Now, you think about that for a second. I would love to hear a lot more from people actually telling us, well, what have you learned from this man, right? Like, what can you yourself take from him and the life that he lived? What can you get from that? And a big part of it has to be not simply about how you can be more like him, but how you damn sure don't ever want to be like the people that were spitting on him, that you don't want to be like the people that were turning dogs on him, that you don't want to carry on the work that they're doing. And a lot of y'all, to be perfectly honest, don't think about it in these terms, but are probably carrying on and exhibiting the behaviors of those people, those who were opposed to the man that you just turned into a quote book on love. But he was it, man. He was that guy. Like, I find myself very often, like when we talk about Michael Jordan and you talk to young people about him and they just think we just a bunch of old people and we just can't acknowledge the fact that somebody might have come later than our heroes and actually been better than them. And it's like, nah, 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 nah. Actually, you don't get it. Like, this dude really is that. And with King, I think when I was younger and less informed, I could read about him and not fully get it, in part because he had been reduced to being such a docile figure by the people that control most of the information. But nah, 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 nah. That dude is actually like more majestic and more important than I think that people probably even realized in the time that it was happening, at the time that he was, for lack of a better term, in his prime. And the key with him is clarity, the moral clarity in what King did and what King said. There is no confusion. I say this every year, that if you see somebody manipulate a quote from Martin Luther King to serve their interests, it ain't by accident, because it's not possible to do it by accident. What he's saying and where it's coming from is so crystal clear that if you're using it for purposes anything other than what he was talking about, you're doing it because you want to. You're doing it because you're wrong. No other way around that. So when you think of this time and you think of this holiday and you think of this man, if nothing else, remember that clarity and hope. As I hope for myself and I hope for everybody else on this, on matters of right or wrong, that nobody has any confusion about where you stand. Because honestly, if they got a little bit of confusion, they actually might not be confused at all. Just not in the way that you want them to think of you. Joining us now, one of my absolute favorite columnists working right now. And I feel like right now, like, writing columns is a bit of a lost art at this point. And this is a legitimate master who also has a book out now called The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. His name is Mike Sielski. Mike, what's going on?
Bo, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Dude, no problem. And actually, before we get to the book, I mentioned a thing about columns, and you write for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and this is actually like a thing for me because, you know, in the era of, like, it's one thing to put up a post, but like I do feel like a newspaper column on a topic is a different sort of animal. And you managed to write columns where I remember the one that really stuck out with me was something, I think, with regards to the name of the Washington football team. And I absolutely did not agree with what you were saying, but I was like, but I can't say any of this is wrong. Like, I can't throw any of this out of there. So am I just being the old man and saying, like, I really do kind of feel like the column writing is becoming a bit of a lost art?
No, you're not the only person to express that to me. And it's something that I think about and talk about with people in the business all the time. And I think it's one of those things that, with certain exceptions, like somebody like Dan Wetzel at Yahoo, let's say, the local sports columnist still to a degree has some value as a voice or the voice of a marketplace, right? If you want to know what's going on in Boston, you got to read Dan Shaughnessy, you know, or Chris Gasper or Bob Ryan. If you want to know New York sports, you got to read Mike Vaccaro at The Post and Bill Plaschke in LA. I'd like to think of myself as being one of those kinds of people, right? Like, if you want to know what's going on in Philly sports, if you want to have experience kind of a thoughtful take, but still a strong opinion, and have it be deeper than a post on Twitter, a local talk radio rant, hopefully I'm filling that void.
I will tell you one thing the local columnists can still do, not pointing this directly at you, but you will appreciate this. We can still get you fired. Like, I was like, you mentioned Plaschke. When Plaschke wrote that column about Clay Helton at USC, I was like, oh, you're done in this town.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I had his cachet in Philly, the kind of cachet in Philly that he has in L.A., man. He's got the hammer.
All right, so the book, Kobe Bryant, The Rise, what drew you to this topic?
So, I mean, I've grown up and lived in the Philadelphia area for most of my life. And so after Kobe died in January of 2020, I ended up writing several pieces about him for The Inquirer. And the more that I did and the more that I talked to people around here, particularly ones who I'd known for a while, I thought, you know, there's a story here that, because Philadelphia is so parochial, kind of like an almost an under the dome kind of situation, that everybody in our area probably knows pretty well, but that the broader population, whether it's around the country or around the world, may not know as well. And that was Kobe's origin story. Because he joined the Lakers so young, he was only 17, it was kind of like he sprouted fully formed out of a hill in Hollywood. And everybody kind of got to see him grow up and see the good stuff and the bad stuff and all of that. And yet there was these first 17 years of his life in and around Philly for the most part. And I thought that if I told that story the right way, you could get a sense of why Kobe became the man and the figure that he became. So that was just kind of it. And I got a couple key people who knew him way back when to help me out, you know, to agree to talk to me, and the ball got rolling.
You know, one interesting thing about Kobe and Philadelphia is the relationship, at least from the outside, has always appeared to be a bit fraught. Because his father's from Philadelphia. He is, if you ask where he's from, he is from Philadelphia, except he's also kind of from Italy. And from here, it always seemed like there was an appreciation for him from Philadelphia, but it's not like Philly threw its arms around him in the way of saying he's ours. Like, is that a fair characterization?
That's totally fair. I think there's a couple things at work there. Number one, Kobe aspired to be bigger than Philadelphia. And there's something about the region and the city that kind of finds that off-putting. Like, why don't you like us? Like, why wouldn't you want to stay here and be in Philadelphia for the rest of your life and play and dream of playing for the Sixers? So that's part of it. The other part of it is he technically isn't from the city. He grew up in Lower Merion Township, which is just outside the city. It is not technically Philadelphia, and Philadelphians are so territorial and so parochial that a lot of them didn't like Kobe saying, well, I'm from Philly. Well, no, you're not. You're from Lower Merion. And then the final thing is, and you know this as well as anybody, because Kobe ends up playing 20 years with the Lakers, because he becomes a figure known for his competitiveness and chasing championships and wanting to win, he's exactly the kind of athlete that Philadelphians hate when he plays somewhere else, but would have loved forever if he played in the city for the Sixers. And so there was always that love-hate kind of thing, you know, the 0-1 finals where he wants to cut the hearts out of the Sixers and their fans, and people got all over him for that. They boom at the All-Star game the following year, but by the time he retires, it's all love because there's an appreciation for how great a player he has been.
You know, that parochial element of Philadelphia is interesting because I think we associate that typically a lot more with the Midwest. Like, if you tell me that about Pittsburgh or Cleveland being a great example of that, when we saw that when LeBron left, that a big part of that is what you say, we're not good enough. You're saying Cleveland ain't good enough. Philadelphia feels, at least from the outside, as being so much bigger that you would think from where we sit that that would not necessarily be that way. But I had a roommate from Philadelphia in college, and I quickly learned exactly what it was that you were talking about.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's that we're stuck between New York and D.C. Like, you know, there's the cultural and financial capital of the world to the north, and there's the political capital of the world to the south. And what are we? We have sports. I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it's something in the water. I wish I knew, but it's very thick. It's very there all the time. I once had a, and it's usually you think of it in terms of football, right? Like with the Eagles. I mean, the Eagles just dominate discussion around here. But, you know, it's true of all four sports teams and the Sixers in particular, you know, within the last 5 to 10 years, I'd say.
You know, you mentioned something interesting also about Kobe as a person where if he played for the Sixers, they would have loved him, but he did not, therefore went the other direction. And it just made me think something I'd never really considered. What if Allen Iverson had played for the Lakers and Kobe Bryant had played for the Sixers? Right? Like what the locals and everybody else would say about either.
Could you imagine? I mean, you know, and I get into that in the book that John Lucas, who was the Sixers coach the year before the 96 draft, when Iverson and Kobe both came out, Lucas got Kobe to work out with the team in the summer of 95 and scrimmage with them. And he wanted to take Kobe in the 96 draft. He got fired before the 96 draft, so he couldn't do it. And then the Sixers end up with the number one pick. There's some discussions in their front office. Should we take Kobe? We've got this kid in our backyard. What do we want to do? And in the end, they just decide, you know what? We need a star. We need scoring. We're going to take Allen Iverson. And that takes us in the whole direction of like high school players at that time and how they were perceived to be risky. And Kevin Garnett had just come out the year before, but he was 7 feet tall and a man at age 18. And Kobe was 6'6 and wispy and had played in the burbs and all that stuff. So it is. It's a fun game to play of like, what if the Sixers had taken Kobe and Iverson had ended up with the Lakers? How different would things have been?
So with this book, he's talking about the first 17 years of Kobe's life. And I think that for those of us, like, I graduated from high school the year after him, right? So, like, I realized after Kobe died, it was like, oh, I've basically grown up with Kobe Bryant. Like, my ability to appreciate and understand sports and people has changed as he has changed. Like, the way I looked at him when I was 18, and I'm looking at him like, you're supposed to have it all figured out, because I think I have it all figured out, right? Which is, like, the most ridiculous concept in the world. But I hadn't thought until this book really about not just Kobe as teenager, but, like, Kobe before that. What do you think like is interesting that you picked up about a childhood Kobe Bryant?
Yeah, you know, we all think of Kobe as being super intense, super competitive, having prepared himself to be a great player from, you know, the time he was small. But even I don't think had an appreciation for how intense that preparation was at an early age. You know, the Bryant family is in Italy and he's watching Joe at practice with his Italian professional teams, and he's dribbling and mimicking the players, and he's watching them to see their footwork and their fundamentals. And when they come back to the Philly area in the summertime, he's playing in summer leagues, and he's icing his knees and his elbows because he sees that's what Joe does and that's what these Italian professional players do. I've gotten asked a lot, Bo, about was it nature or nurture with Kobe? And to me, it was like 50-50, absolutely perfect. He was born with this incredible inner drive, and he was born into a family and an environment that cultivated that. And so I don't think I really understood that until I started reporting and researching his life at that stage of just how he planned this from the time he could think in those terms. And it was kind of eye-opening.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I feel like with a lot of great athletes, I'd even go so far as to say most, that you can have a moment where they could go back and be like, this is when I realized I had something special, right? Like, it's one thing to know that I was kind of good at this, but then something happens. You go to some camp or you play against some guy and you realize, oh, okay, this is something different. Like, there's a story of John Elway where apparently his first peewee football game, his dad came late and his dad asked what's going on. And somebody said, well, either your kid is the best player of all time or all of ours are the worst, right? Like, that's the moment that you realize yes. It. With Kobe, it doesn't sound like, at least for him, that there was any such moment, that from the beginning he seemed to believe this, and not just believe it, but know it.
You are 100% right about that. And he would tell people in eighth grade, like, the family moves back to suburban Philly in the fall of 1991, and he's already telling people, like, I'm going to play in the NBA as an eighth grader. And the steps that he was willing to take to get to that point or what stand out to me. Like, quick example. So he has a friend who's a couple years older than him. And so the two of them, when Kobe was 14 or 15, would drive around to playgrounds and courts, outdoor courts in and around Philly. The friend would have two jobs during these pickup games. He was to rebound for Kobe while Kobe was working on his footwork and dunking and shooting threes and all this stuff. And he was to scream at Kobe, "You're soft. You go to a white school. You're not tough enough to play in the public league." And Kobe wanted him to do this because A, he was already kind of hearing this from his peers, and B, he knew he was going to hear it more and more as he got older and into the NBA, you know, what he perceived to be his eventual career in the NBA. So he wanted to kind of like put emotional armor on himself at an early age. He's 14 or 15. Like, I think back to when I'm 14 or 15, I struggled to talk to a member of the opposite sex. And this kid is like preparing himself from a mental standpoint to get ready to star in the NBA. And I think that was, to me, the thing that really jumped out, how every single step along the way, he was getting ready for what he eventually became.
What a great friend, by the way.
Yeah, how about it?
And that actually, because one thing I was actually kind of curious about in this is, one thing we don't think about too much with Kobe is friends. Right? Like, this is the guy who had said at one point, you know, friendships come and go, banners last forever. Like, that seemed to be his outlook. And so I was curious to know, and that kind of gives a little indication, but, you know, but like Kobe as just guy at school or Kobe as guy with friends, like what you came away with in your research from that?
Started out as an outsider, you know, he and his older sisters land November 91. Kobe's in eighth grade. The following year, he's in ninth grade. All three of them are at the high school. And they would wear, you know, European-style clothing or dashikis. When they passed each other in the hallway, they would speak to each other in Italian because that was the language that was most familiar to them in a school setting. And they could talk to each other and nobody else would know what they were saying. And so you have that aspect. And then basketball is his way in. It's the way to meet people. It's the way to open him up to the different crowds that he eventually became friends with, so to speak. He could speak to the basketball players. He could speak to the kids in the honors English class in 10th grade. He could speak to the other kids who liked rap music and were going around trying to get into studios in the Philly area. He didn't really have a core close group of friends, but he could move in these various circles. One of the aspects that I really liked getting into that I knew nothing about until I started the research was the fact that Kobe joined the Lower Merion Black Student Union. The student voice. Like, he was a kid at that time. He knew what he was basketball-wise, or at least thought he was, but he was searching to figure out, what is my identity? Who am I really? And by the time he leaves Lower Merion, he's the most important popular figure on campus, but there's still that kind of distance. Everybody knows he's on to bigger and better things. He knows he's on to bigger and better things. And so there's this sense of pride that everybody has in him, but there's also this sense of, like, he's kind of apart from us too.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of almost an adolescent dilemma in a lot of ways, but I guess it carries with a lot of people, which is he absolutely wanted to stand apart because that made sense because of his talent, while also kind of wanting to fit in and trying to reconcile these two ideas.
Yeah, I think I have a line in the book that he tried on personalities like clothes, like clothing outfits. And I think he did that for a long, long time. One of the things I included in the book, in 07, when he was still kind of on his image rehab tour after Aurora, Colorado, I got to talk to him after a Sixers game. And I asked him, I'd heard a rumor that he was thinking about trying to join the Sixers to end his career playing in Philly. And I asked him about that. And he said, you know, that in high school, that's kind of all I thought about. But the way he answered the question made it clear that he was kind of weighing, what should I say here? Am I saying exactly what I believe in my heart? Or am I saying the thing that is advantageous to me or that people want to hear? And he was always that kind of, there was always that calculating side to him of like, how can I gain an advantage or help myself a little bit by doing something or saying something?
Yeah, because I think something I can probably relate to a degree is, I think that Kobe has made it clear to us that he kind of didn't really care what we thought of him, but you still would prefer that people do think good things, right? Like, mm-hmm. even if you have a macro level indifference, you're not voting for them to hate you. Like, I think after the Colorado, there was a resignation that with some people that was always going to be the case, but that don't mean that's what you want, you know?
Right. No, that's exactly right. And you see that in high school, too. There's very much kind of a they hate me because they ain't me kind of vibe to him. You know, like I got these tapes of Kobe, these interviews that he had done when he was 17, 18, 19 years old for a book project that he was involved with that never went anywhere. A guy named Jeremy Treatment. Anyway, he talks on that about taking Brandy to the senior prom in 1996. And he talks about how much he resents his classmates because they resented him for bringing Brandy. Like, Kobe made the prom about him, and he doesn't like that. It's not that he is recoiling from the fame itself. He's recoiling from people recoiling from his fame. It's like, I'm Kobe Bryant. This is who I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to bring Brandy to the prom. Why don't you all get that and understand it? And I think that's something that kind of carried throughout his life.
And on top of it, what I'm supposed to do, say no?
Exactly.
Like look who you with. Look who I'm with. You want to trade? I bet you want to trade, right? Like, because I remember watching the videos of those students, and like, I get it to an extent, you know, where it is that they are coming from. Except, nah. Like, Brandy says she want to go to the prom with me. Guess what? We're going to the prom. But for them, I wonder if it's to a degree where. We see this happen a lot where once you're done playing games at the school doesn't necessarily feel the same way about you.
You know, that's an interesting point. And I think that was probably true of some of the students at Lower Merion. But I don't think, you know, I'm not even sure it was the majority. I think you're definitely right that there was that feeling there. But by the same token, he had been kind of this force in the community. And I get into this in the book about how, you know, when you hear Lower Merion, you hear the main line of Philadelphia, certain images and stereotypes come to mind. Old money, WASPs, you know, that kind of thing. And there was this other side of the community that people aren't as familiar with, you know, where the black members of the community lived and the experiences that they had. And Kobe was kind of caught between those two worlds. And by the time he graduates, he's done a lot to kind of be a point of pride for everybody in that community. Doesn't matter if you're black, doesn't matter if you're white, doesn't matter if you're got a ton of money, doesn't matter if you don't. Like, cool, we got the best high school basketball player in the country in our backyard, and he's playing at our local high school. There's obviously going to be resentment with that. And Kobe, to be fair, like fed some of that himself, right? Like senior year, he's getting to school by 5:30 in the morning to work out. He's getting to school before the principal, before any of the teachers, any of the students, a janitor's letting him in the building so that he can shoot baskets. And he's parking his car, his SUV, in one of the prime parking spots. And they let him do it, and people resented him for it, but his attitude was, I'm Kobe Bryant. I'm going to be better at my job than the principal is at his, than all the teachers are at theirs, and then all my peers are going to be at their jobs when they get their jobs. So I'm going to do this. And so it's both sides. It's the environment. Like, yeah, of course we're going to resent the outsider, you know, who does he think he is kind of a thing. But it's also Kobe saying, you know, again, you're not me and I can do what I want to do.
Yeah, like it seemed in some ways, I think about the press conference when he said that he was going to the NBA, which I don't know how more people don't talk about this, where he basically coined the phrase, I am taking my talents too, mm-hmm. right? Like that was LeBron, a generation below Kobe, using the same Kobe phrasing when he did that with the decision. But I remember he was wearing this like a gray double-breasted jacket, and I always remember he had sunglasses sitting on his forehead. And I look back on that now as an adult, and I'm like, oh, that's a 17-year-old thinking he looks cool right now, right? Like he was absolutely trying to give I'm the guy going to the NBA energy, which I can now look back on it as an adult and be like, oh, yeah, man, just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, not only trying to figure out, but understanding the control that he had over his future. Like that press conference drove people crazy in Philadelphia. It drove guys like me who had my job, you know, stereotypical seasoned sports columnist or talk radio guy or, you know, old time basketball friend, drove them crazy. Who does this kid think he is? To use that phrase, I'm going to take my talent to the NBA and wear the sunglasses and be so self-assured. But I see that as kind of a vanguard moment in basketball culture in this country because Kobe was saying, you know what? Mike Krzyzewski and Speedy Morris at LaSalle and Dean Smith at North Carolina need me more than I need them. And I can do this. I've been preparing my whole life for this. And you watch that press conference now, it's like he's an actor or a talk show host. He is so self-assured. He looks like he's going to be a star at 17. And it's really, I agree with you completely. It's like this kind of touchstone thing that more people should remember and kind of pay attention to.
Well, one thing I think about with Kobe, and I'm curious how this thought goes with the research and the things you got in your book, is where I look at he and LeBron as they stepped into the NBA. And LeBron, there was clearly much more of a machine that had a lot to do with the money behind him and the shoe companies and everything else. But like he had been trained to be not just a basketball star, but be like a front facing figure, a pitch man, all of these things. Right. And he was always ready for that from the very beginning. Because Kobe and Kevin Garnett and all these guys showed we need to push the clock up on when we start getting people ready for this. Kobe wasn't a guy as polished as he was, like in the ways that we think about it, just in a walk around the world sense. But for being prepared to be one of the biggest basketball players in the world, I never got the feeling that molding had taken place with him. Even with the dad that played in the NBA, it wasn't the molding that we see with these guys now, which is kind of interesting to think about because it does feel like he was figuring out, I'm sure he had advisors and things, but still was figuring out a lot of things on his own. But at that point, we didn't know that guys were going to be ready for this, and he was the one learning on the fly while also maybe having a bigger profile than any high school player had had at that point.
Absolutely right. And the learning was all kind of from him. His mom and dad, even like leading into that press conference, were kind of hesitant. Like, do you want to have a press conference? Maybe we should have a press conference. What are you going to say at the press conference? And he's like, Dad, I got this. And one of his friends said to me, or it might have been even Sonny Vaccaro, you know, who was at Adidas at the time and signed Kobe, said Kobe was always one step ahead of everybody else. And what's interesting about your point about LeBron and kind of the machine around him, Kobe had a very tight-knit circle. He had his parents, he had a couple of people he confided in, and that's it. For instance, he never told his high school coach, Greg Downer, explicitly, I'm going to the NBA. Never told him that. It was like he compartmentalized things even at that young age. He knew coming off of the summer of 1995 when he scrimmages against Jerry Stackhouse and Rick Mahorn and Sean Bradley and Sherrone Wright and is holding his own and then some against those guys. That's all he needed to see. That's it. I'm going to the NBA. I can do this. He doesn't tell anybody that. And he revels in kind of holding the secret from everybody else. He lets people think, oh yeah, I might go to LaSalle and play for my dad, who's an assistant coach there. Might go to Duke, really like Coach K. Might go to the NBA, I don't know yet. He knows the entire time, but he's got this thing in him that's just kind of naturally there. And that, you know, by going through this process, I think kind of to your point, kind of becomes a training ground for him once he joins the Lakers and enters the NBA, that he's able to kind of handle all of that. It's not so much that the machinery is put up around him as was with LeBron. It's that Kobe understood how to work within the machinery, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you say that he didn't tell the high school coach because we were just reading the magazines in 95 and 96. Yeah. And we knew he wasn't going to no college. that had never come up as a consideration.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe it was a Philadelphia thing. Mm. But in Philly, there was definitely the sense of like, I mean, if you could see the writing on the wall that, you know, it's looking like he's going to jump. But there was still this thing about, is he not? You know, there were people writing columns saying he shouldn't, he's not ready, all of this kind of stuff. But he knew the entire time.
I think the saddest part of the Kobe Bryant story, especially with his death being so premature, is the disintegration of his relationship with his parents. And with the research from the book, what was the relationship then?
Incredibly close. Incredibly close. Kobe saw himself in a lot of ways as like the vehicle or the vessel for Joe Bryant to reclaim his place as an NBA player and a basketball star. Joe had been an incredible high school player in Philadelphia. He had been a tremendous college player at LaSalle. He left early. If he had stayed an extra year, he probably would have been the number one pick in the subsequent draft. He plays 8 years. He's kind of a ne'er-do-well, kind of a free spirit. He's 6'9". He's really skilled, but nobody knows what to do with him. This is before Magic comes along. He doesn't have the kind of, you know, day-to-day drive that Kobe does. And he has to go to Europe to kind of fulfill his basketball destiny, so to speak. Kobe saw that and was like, I'm going to redeem my dad's good name. When they talk about the Bryant name in basketball, they will talk about it as royalty because of me, and they will have to include my father in that. Then you have his mother, who, you know, the matriarch, strong woman, raised devoutly Catholic, you know, very rigorous in terms of raising her three kids when it comes to academics, religion, things like that, but also kind of indulgent, particularly when it comes to basketball. And the fact that Kobe was the youngest of the three, you know, he was her baby. And they were very, very close right up until, you know, the early 2000s. And then things changed from there.
It's interesting that you say that about Kobe and his dad and reclaiming the name, because one thing I always found interesting is, you never got the camera shots of Joe Bryant in the crowd like you do Dale Curry, right? Now, part of that, of course, is that I think we knew Dale Curry a little bit better than most people knew Joe Bryant. But it always seemed interesting to me that as Kobe was coming up, I never felt like I got a better knowledge and understanding of Joe Bryant as someone who wasn't familiar with him. But though you normally do when somebody has a son that goes into the NBA, was that kind of stuff conscious or intentional?
I don't know if it was intentional. I think it was more a matter of just them being different in kind of profound basketball ways and even personality ways. One writer described Joe Bryant as having 2 minutes for everybody and 2 hours for nobody. And you wouldn't think of Kobe that way, right? Like, say what you want about him. He fancied himself and he was perceived to be a deep thinker and really was, you know. You saw that in his post-basketball life in terms of what he was doing and, you know, filmmaking, storytelling, the Mamba mentality, all of that kind of stuff. So I think that's kind of a function of it too, and that their games were different, right? Like, Del Curry was a hell of a shooter and his sons are incredible shooters. So it's a little bit easier that way too, just to draw the basketball parallel.
Right. One thing I'm curious about with Kobe's personality when he was younger, I've told this story on here before, but the first time I ever did work in a locker room was at a charity game in 2005 for Hurricane Katrina, and I was terrified. Totally 100% terrified. And I did not understand that people were there literally to sit around and wait for you to come talk to them. Like, I just didn't know how any of it worked. They're like, yo, you want to go cover this game? Okay. Then I got there and I'm shook. Like, I'm standing in this corner. And the first person I ever talked to in the locker room was Kobe Bryant, because he looked at me and recognized how terrified I was and kind of encouraged me to come over and was very nice about it. And I wondered if that was something that was evident in his personality as a person in high school, like recognizing, we could talk about, he realized that he was a part, and he did, but that often also comes with a recognition of a certain care that you need to have towards some other people.
I think that's 100% right. You see that in interactions that he has with students and friends who aren't affiliated with the basketball team. You know, girls in his class who, you know, might sing the national anthem or be involved in the choir. Or there's one anecdote I have in there where he has a friend who's on the girls' junior varsity basketball team and she's thinking about quitting and he counsels her not to do it. I do think that was that side of him that, you know, if you weren't competing against me and, you know, I can see some vulnerability in you, you know, similar to a young reporter who doesn't know what he's doing in the locker room. And believe me, I've been there too. I'm willing to help throw a helping hand there. I think the timing of that, though, of the story you're telling is interesting because it's 2005 and that's after what we talked about, you know, in 03 and 04. So maybe a little bit more of like, hey, I gotta do my part here to like create the impression or just be a better person than I've been.
That part, I don't think I fully recognized in 04 and 05, because I guess there was a distance. I was not like intimately involved in sports writing in the way that, you know, and all that stuff that I am now. Just how bad it was for his reputation. Like, I don't know if I realized how good the reputation was on the front end or how bad it had gotten on the back end. But in looking back, it is one of the more interesting inflection points for anyone. I wonder if looking at everything and getting more immersed in his young life gives a different perspective on those turns that happened for him as an adult.
Yeah, it does and it doesn't. I mean, it's one of the challenges that I recognized early on in doing the research was, boy, I don't want to have to be ham-handed or shoehorn references to Colorado into this narrative, right? Because there is an expectation that you're going to have to address them. I had to. You know, this is a book about Kobe Bryant, who's the best person in the history of people. I wanted it to be a full look at him. And so it was important to me to be able to address that in kind of a natural way. And I did uncover, I don't want to ruin it for people who haven't read the book yet, but I did uncover an anecdote that kind of spoke to that early in his life from his senior year of high school that kind of just touched on that a little bit. And so, yeah, I mean, to me, he's just a complex guy. There's always going to be this mystery at the heart of him, like how much of what he did and said away from the basketball court itself was totally sincere and how much of it was calculation and image and, you know, this is who I think I ought to be or who I think I am. And I don't know if there's ever going to be anybody who kind of captures that aspect of him. But yeah, I did see it. That mystery is there even early in his life.
Well, the book is called The Rise. Check it out, about Kobe Bryant, first 17 years of his life. And I always, when I talk to people about this, because I have such a profound respect for anybody that can sit down and tackle a book and everything that comes with it. Because I once wrote a book proposal that had a sample chapter. And I realized that the job is to write the best thing you ever thought you wrote and have somebody tell you how not good it is. And then come back and write the best thing you ever thought you wrote and have somebody come back and tell you how not good it is. So for you, how does it feel now, having this done, having this out, exploring this fascinating topic?
It feels great. I mean, you know, it was more than a year of work. I started working on it in March of 2020, finished the manuscript a year later, been going through the edits and all that stuff. And, you know, I mean, I'm talking about it a lot, which is kind of, that's par for the course. And but, you know, it feels like, you know, my hope in writing the book when I took on the project was I want to write a kind of book that stands the test of time, that if somebody 10 to 15 years from now wants to learn about Kobe Bryant, this is a book or the book that they would go to first to understand him. And I can only hope that I met that goal.
Take a bow, sir. It's okay. Take a bow.
Thanks.
I'll let you do the humility, and I will say congratulations to you and to everybody else. Check out the book, The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. It is available right now. Mike Silski, thank you so much for joining us here. I greatly appreciate it.
Not as much as I appreciate it, Bo. Thank you.
No problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this three times a week. Gabe Bassane and Adi Khan handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.